Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. This is episode 30, which is a review of episodes 21 to 29 with clips from each episode. It's not a best of because that's personal choice, but just a few clips to give you a flavour so that you can dive into the full episodes if you want to. Episode 21 was with the author Mick Smith, PhD, on his book Burning America, In the Best Interest of the Children.
The whole process, I'd say, when people ask, like, what did you write? Well, first of all, I wrote for myself. There's no question about it, because I was so traumatized by these events and so disturbed and so thrown off kilter by it. I said, you know, I need to get this out. So I have all of this inside of me and a whole range of emotions. You know, there's anger and embarrassment and, you know, alone and loneliness and what have you. And I said, I just need to get it out in some way and express it, because it was a story that I felt needed to be told. So the first part of it was I just wanted to write and write for myself. So it's no question, it was completely catharsis. It just made me feel better to get the ideas out there. And then I started saying, well, what do I do with it now that I have this manuscript? And I think the odd thing about it is that I actually sat on this for quite a long time. And then lo and behold, some years later, about 20 years later, almost to the T, the same thing happened to my best friend. And I said, you know, this is just insane. How could this possibly happen? Nothing has improved in the last 20 years. And I said, that's what pushed me over the edge. And I said, you know, I need to get this story out, because if it happened to me, it happened to my best friend. And, you know, just talking to people and you find out this is far more common, at least in the States. There's something like a million people that are in the custody situation in the United States. And that's just an incredible amount of people. And it also means that if you've got one child or several children, this is really unfortunate for these children who are stuck in this system. So I said, yep, I got to get this out and I have to tell the story. When you experience some sort of trauma, look out for yourself. And the old saying is, look out for number one. Absolutely. You need to make yourself very healthy and to survive. So I think a lot of people would say, I certainly did. People would ask, how are you? Well, I'm okay. Well, no, not really, because I just experienced trauma. So I go back to the basics. And this is, make sure you're getting your sleep that you need. Make sure that you're eating correctly. Make sure you're exercising. All the things that you really need to do as a human being, and also will help you to survive the trauma that you've experienced. So I think go back to the basics and all the things that, you know, your physician is going to be telling you all the time anyway. Now you definitely have to do it, because it will help you, and it will help you to survive, and then not only survive, but to thrive, because there is a day that's coming that this will be behind you. And the way to put it behind you is to make sure that you are healthy physically, mentally, spiritually, in all the ways that you can to thrive post-trauma. Work on things while you're experiencing it. And it also, just the healing process is, like I said, I think a lot of people feel strongly about getting a story out there. And when I had mentioned the same or similar situation happened to my best friend, he's a songwriter. So, I mean, he wrote a song about it. So, I mean, anything you can do, it's the sort of idea that these things will tear you up inside, and getting it out in some way, in some expressive way. So people will exercise, they'll do yoga, they'll meditate, they'll pray, whatever it might be that's within you, it's always to get it out there. So it's writing, singing, moving of some sort. And I think that's what is healthy for a person to do. I think this is an international problem. And I think that's where we all as parents actually can guide each other and help one another, because it's a much larger issue than just one country, because I think it's a worldwide issue. And I think what we can do is to work locally. And so there's a phrase that says, you know, think globally, but act locally. I go, yeah, there's something to that, because we can help and assist one another globally, but then whatever your particular situation is, act on a local basis. And some other states, England, for example, has a unitary system as opposed to the United States with 50 individual states. If you can get something done in one country, in England, it has a large influence on the entire country. So there's an advantage there as opposed to some other countries where we have local jurisdictions and then competing jurisdictions. For example, in the United States, we have local, we have municipalities, counties, states, and then the federal government. So there are several levels. And that's why in some ways the states are more difficult. That has to do with the way that we have evolved as a country. But I think always thinking locally. So this is always the hope. If people say, well, you can get overwhelmed with the issue, of course you can. But the thing is, you know people that I don't know. I know people that you don't know. So the point here is that work and what you can do around the people that you do know. And then collectively, you can start getting change. Because if everybody's locally working, what does that mean? That somehow we're going to start seeing the results and the benefits and the fruits of the labor that we are all advocating for. Keep remembering you are not alone, and you not only just survive, but you can thrive. There is a day that's coming, and it's going to be a day that you're going to enjoy.
Episode 22 was with Anna Maria Didio, an author and parent. She discusses her experience of adoption and her books on the subject.
In my own story, it revolves around parental alienation. And I think many of the listeners similarly have cases of this. But what I found was in the content of your books and the themes, there seem to be some parallels there. You're talking about adoption. You know, another refreshing thing I found was that you're talking about adoption from the child's point of view. And some of the aspects such as loss and identity are similar to themes within parental alienation and other forms of parent-child separation. Could you talk to us a little bit about how those themes that you mentioned, sure, trauma and attachment, identity and grief, how do they relate for those of us who don't know? How do they relate to the adoption experience so that we can learn a little bit more?
Sure. Well, my fundamental premise and the base, the crux of the adoption theory, if you will, is that all adoption begins with the trauma of separation and loss. So no matter at what age, and my daughter has, an interesting situation that I can talk about in a second, but the separation from the biological mother creates a trauma that's known as primal wound. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with that, but it's something that I came upon, later in our process, and just reading and understanding it revealed so much to me in terms of the struggles my daughter was experiencing. So trauma, can manifest itself at any point within a child's life. And when we started to see those behaviors, we were wondering, what is this all about? Why is she acting like this? What's happening? We love her so much. And that's, kind of beside the point, is that the love of a family really doesn't take away the pain of the family that she lost, or the, we adopted her at age 7. So that was a very unique situation. She lost another family in Mexico, the family of caregivers. So there were so many losses that I did not take into consideration. And again, you stated it so perfectly. My mission is to really bring these things to the forefront so that families can discuss them and understand them.
It's very profound to hear you talk about that, because, you've described how the love of a family, has not stopped the trauma. And I guess it's different, yes, for each child. Some can experience extreme trauma or mild, but it's, I guess it's always there. And so I guess some families might think, well, we just have to love this child as much as possible. And I wonder whether they, I guess it's different in each country as well as to whether parents have access to education on these themes, or whether it's through books such as yourself, because I've not come across, I find it really interesting that you're writing about this, because I mean, I've got friends who've adopted and I've got friends who've been adopted, but I haven't heard about books talking about the things you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the trauma can, as I said, manifest itself in different ways. For instance, in my second book, my second children's book, that's called How I Wonder Where You Are. As I said, a loving family doesn't take away that pain, doesn't take away that wondering. There in the story, her name is Carla, and she has a sister that's the biological daughter of the family. And when they're out shopping, when they're out at the supermarket or whatever, you know, other people will say to the biological daughter, "Oh, you look so much like your mother," but that's not the adopted child's experience. Mm. You know, who does she look like? Who does she sound like? How is she, you know, what are her biological roots? So the fact that she's wondering and asking questions about it is perfectly normal and appropriate. And that's kind of what I try to communicate in the book. It's not a statement against the family or a question of love. As you said, you know, the love is there and the love is so important and it's important to be supported, but an adoptive family should be accepting of this wondering and questions, and it's all perfectly normal.
Yeah.
But one thing I mention in the book, in my note to parents, is that, you know, the child is changing and support changes through the years. In my first book, my first children's book, Many People to Love, it's a little bit more of the international story in that the main character comes to the U.S., you know, to live after living a number of years in Colombia. Mm-hmm. So she has many trauma kind of manifests itself in many behaviors, and it perhaps it does wrap up a little bit neatly at the end, but again, the point of the books is to illustrate that it's not that love will not solve everything, and that parents do need to discuss the separation, the loss, the grief, the adjustment that needs to take place. Mm. So I hope that my books, you know, do that and open the conversation for families. The second book, The Triggering Event, is a family tree. I don't know if that's as typical a assignment in the UK as it is in the US. It seems like every time our daughters were being asked to put together a family tree, and for our adopted daughter, that was such a challenge. You know, she had just joined our family, and we were introducing her via, you know, sometimes computer, sometimes pictures, some visits, phone calls, and it was tough. So these are events that you know, we consider everyday events, but that can be triggering for children that are adopted. So again, the point of the book is to bring these things to the forefront so families are prepared. Well, I've always enjoyed writing, but as we were going through the adoption process, there were so many unexpected surprises. Just, what was Mexico really like? I'd been there on vacation, but I'd never seen, you know, an orphanage, and just all of these interesting twists and turns. I thought, you know, I'm going to start writing about it. So I did that for many years before I thought, you know, I'm going to pull all this together and put it in a book, because as the girls kind of grew together and not so really together, they turned out to have completely different personalities. Yeah. And it was very entertaining to me, actually. It's some of the book is funny stories that happened to our family and how the two of them worked well together and did not work so well together. And so all of that just I captured in a spiral notebook. And just kept going back to it. And then one weekend I scribbled an outline together, and I thought, you know, this could definitely be a book. And that's how that, process sort of started. And I had a friend who was a writer, and she would read the chapters and give me feedback. So it was very informal. And then it became, more formal as I worked and edited and re-edited, and it looked at it so many times. But to me, it was a fun process, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. The children's books, the three, now there's a third one that's about to be launched, as we speak in June sometime. The illustrations are just being completed. Mm-hmm. The events in those books all happen to our family in one way, shape, or form. So because they were so important to us as a family to enhance and help our communication and our support of this child, the support of our children, I wanted to condense those stories to a children's book to enable other families to learn from them as well. Part of the reason in writing these books is that, I say very freely that I was not prepared for some of these traumatic events. Yeah. And my hope is that the books will help prepare parents. But I just thought our love and our support would solve everything. But she needed time. She needed support. She needed understanding. And eventually we did get there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, actually, because with the issues of identity, some people go through their whole life, even if they're not been adopted, they can still go through life wondering who they are, mm-hmm. and why they're like they are in relation to their family or their friends. And some people can feel mm-hmm. different for all exactly. sorts of reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's they're interesting questions that you're raising.
Episode 23 was on suicide with Colin Hughes, who has a very raw and real experience of his grandchild who committed suicide, and we discussed that and suicide prevention in general.
That morning that I got the call, it's my daughter's phone number.
Yeah.
And I thought, so I thought my daughter was calling me. I just answered, "Hey, honey, how you doing?" And it was her husband, the stepfather of my granddaughter.
Yeah.
And I knew something was wrong then, but, I had no idea what until he told me that my granddaughter had ended her life. My wife is a social worker. Mm-hmm. And during that dreadful day a few years ago in Las Vegas where the shooting, where all those people were killed.
Yeah.
My wife was asked to go down and, triage people from this horrible experience they went through. And some of the people, who have done a lot of this, said, when you notify somebody, because there's all the, people from all over the world coming in, trying to find their family or friends who aren't answering their phones. Yeah. And they want to know if these people are alive. And so they went to this center where my wife worked at, and they had the names of all the people who were killed. And she says, "You've got to be, these people are in shock. You can't sugarcoat it. You've got to be right up front with them and say, 'I'm sorry, but your family member is dead.'"
Yeah.
Just right out says, "He didn't make it." "Didn't make what?"
Yes. Yes.
Blunt and to the point. Because something like that can't be sugarcoated, unfortunately. People who do contemplate suicide are, a lot of times, it's not the people that society would expect. Society would say, "Oh, it's, people who are crazy, people this, people that." But a lot of times, it's the average, everyday person.
Yeah.
Just normal, everyday people. Worldwide, the number of suicides is over 800,000 per year.
Wow.
Yeah. The numbers are astronomical. That's my big message, is life is worth living. Yeah. Hope and love do exist in this world. And I said, I'm 66 years old. And a lot of these kids think, oh man, he's old. What's he got left to do in life? Well, I'll tell you, if I was 150 years old and the Grim Reaper was coming for me, he'd have to take me kicking, screaming, and clawing because I'm still going to say, now I get too much more life to live.
Yeah.
We always should say we've got more to do.
If there are people out there who are, you know, perhaps worried for their children or even worried that their children might not be telling them their feelings, is there any advice that you would give them? Or even to children who may be going through dark times themselves and listening to this?
Well, to parents, I would say, when your child comes home from school and you say, how was school today? They say, fine. Mm. Don't let it end there.
Yeah.
Talk to them. Show them genuine interest. They have to know that you are interested in their lives, that you are interested in how their day truly was, not just to say, fine, you know, it's just, well, what was fine about it? Was there anything down about it? Just talk, have a normal conversation like you would with anyone, and not just about school, but about themselves, about their happiness in life, their joy in life, their sadness in life, the things that affect them on a daily basis. Find out what's really going on in their lives. And if there's anything in there whatsoever that has them feeling bad about life, get them help. Here's a story that it saddens me so much. In aviation, it's mental health is a taboo subject. So long you could not take medications and be a pilot, antidepressants. That's changed, but still the roadblocks to trying to get there as a pilot who has depression is horrendous.
Yes. Okay.
If you go see a therapist, you have to report it.
Yeah.
Not just medications, but just talking to somebody. You have to report it. And there was a young man who, he was a private pilot going through University of North Dakota to become a career pilot. And one day he was going to go on a solo cross-country flight, texted everybody after he fueled his airplane up to say goodbye. And his mother reached out, trying to get a hold of everybody out there. It was too late. He took the airplane up, flew it into the ground.
Yeah.
One of his roommates, whose father is an airline captain, this young man's father called him and they were talking. This young man was really understandably having a difficult time and said that he was probably going to go get counseling to get through this. His dad says, don't do that. You'll ruin your career.
Mm. Yes.
How can you tell your child that?
Yeah.
Don't do that. It'll ruin your career. Well, so what?
Yeah.
So what? Yeah. He'll be alive. That is a life or death situation.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to get help no matter who you are. Don't be embarrassed by it.
We've had a couple of authors come on recently, and I was saying to one, I emailed him back, a few days ago, he went to the family court 20 years ago and he wrote a book about it. He didn't publish it for 20 years. He eventually did. And now he does a podcast. He's raising awareness about the suffering and the failings of the system. He's connecting with people. He's teaching people that they're not on their own. And it got me writing. I started a book a few months ago. I spent most of last weekend working on my book, and I emailed him to say, hopefully I'm a better writer than a public speaker, but I emailed him back and I said, you know, thanks for being such a great example, because just him telling his story is like a beacon of light to other people. And it's got me writing. It can get other people writing, or they do a podcast or they do a blog or whatever. And it raises the awareness. And that's what you're doing. You're a fantastic example. And that's so important.
Episode 24 was with Beverly Hills lawyer Raymond Heckmatt, who discusses his practice, prenups, and his work as a divorce consultant and mediator in California.
Is there a formal collaborative movement happening in California, or is that just an approach that you've come to through your earlier experiences?
So there, I wouldn't say that it's formal, but there are groups of collaborative lawyers that join groups with other collaborative attorneys and collaborative accountants that all work together on certain cases. And there's a whole area of law called collaborative law that people say they practice collaborative law. I don't practice in collaborative law. It's a little different. It may not sound very different, but at the end of the day, what collaborative law is, at least here in California, is where you have two parties and each of them has an attorney that is a collaborative attorney. And the two attorneys will work together with other professionals, and everyone is really working together to move the process along. And a lot of times there creates a conflict of interest, because at the end of the day, you still need to represent your client. You need to still not be adversarial, but advocate. And a lot of times that collaborative process takes that away. I believe that there are ways to advocate, but at the same time, mediate and move forward and come to agreements that work for everyone. Well, the thing with collaborative law is sometimes it's too many cooks in the kitchen. There's a lot of people involved, and it sometimes gets more expensive than it needs to be. And that was a big reason why I decided to move into the area that I am now, because I just believed as a family law attorney, there's an inherent conflict of interest, because at the end of the day, the more adversarial you are, the more fights you create as an attorney, the more money you make.
Yes.
And so I believe that there was just a conflict there as an attorney. You want to help someone, but you don't want to help them too much, because if you help them too much, you don't make the money. And there was a conflict there that I just wasn't allowing me to do the job that I want to do for my clients.
You just mentioned, was it daily settlement officers?
What is that? So aside from the mandated mediation, which is through the courthouse, the bar associations here provide daily settlement officers to the courthouse, which are generally volunteer family law attorneys that go to the court. They're scheduled to be at the courthouse on that day. And the day of the hearing, a judge may send your case, down to the settlement offer before they decide, because they think, I don't need to decide this. You guys can probably figure this out on your own with a mediator. How about you go downstairs, talk to that mediator, see if you can work it out, and if you can't, come back up. And so that's been a really great resource for a lot of parties and attorneys, again, to alleviate the judge's workload and to come up with better decisions, because through mediation, through settlement, you can get a lot more creative with your agreement than a judge would. Yes. Judges are a lot of times very black and white. Yes. But if you and your partner work together, you can come up with creative solutions that a judge may not think of, maybe because they don't have time. Or they don't know your children. They don't know who you are. They don't know what your family is like. They're just looking at numbers, and they're looking at declarations that are filled with probably a bunch of lies. And they're just going to make a decision. But you and your partner are the only people that know your children, that know your family, that know your finances, that know have an understanding of what the true needs are. And you can come up with those creative solutions. And I find that that's where mediation thrives.
I hear that some of the states in America are moving or have moved to a presumption of 50-50 shared care. Is that something that's in place in California or is possible in the future?
Yeah, no, it is. So the law does provide that both parties are on equal footing. If they're getting divorced as parents, everyone has exactly the same rights. So the default is going to be joint legal, joint physical custody. It really takes a showing from one party or the other to decide, or to make a showing that one side shouldn't have decision-making power or shouldn't have joint physical custody. But the default is that everyone is in the same place. And you know what? I've had clients that say, well, while we were married, I was the primary caretaker. I took care of the kids all the time. He didn't do anything. Why does he want the kids half the time now? Like, but as a father, you're entitled to that time with your children post separation. And you're a father just as much as that person is a mother. And a lot of times it's, well, you just have to wait and see how it is, how it works out. And if it's not working out, then you go back to court and ask for a change. But generally you start out with equal footing and everyone works out a schedule that works for the children and you see how it goes. And they're always ever changing. Circumstances change, kids' needs change, parents' schedule change, and they're always modifiable. But we always start out with equal footing, as much as one party may not want to. And the second problem is, especially here, I don't know how it is in your country and in England, but there's a huge turnover of judges on a daily basis. Yeah. So just because you had a judge last month doesn't mean you're going to have the same judge this month. We have a lot of judges coming in and out of the family court, many of whom have really no experience with family law whatsoever. And they're put in these decision-making places where they just want to err on the side of caution, you know?
Yes.
A lot of, and they want to protect the children, and they're just going to err on the side of caution for protection's sake. And that's where attorneys take advantage of some of these judges. Yes. Again, we have judges that have never been a family law attorney in their entire careers. They've been practicing law for 30, 40 years, but they've been doing civil litigation. They've been business attorneys. They've been real estate attorneys. They've been contract attorneys, have never practiced a day of family law in their lives, yet we're putting them in a position to make decisions in family law that impact families and children. And when they change hands every few months because they decide that they don't like family law or they need to move to another judge, then you're showing up with a new judge and that person has really no idea what has happened in the past.
Just one other thing about the law in Britain and California. In this country, family court proceedings are pretty much secret. You're not allowed to mention any of the parties, and you can be criticized if you talk about your case anonymously outside of the court. Is that the same in California? Or I mean, I know America has got much more strength in its free speech. Especially at the moment in England, there's a lot of erosion of free speech. There's multiple news stories on multiple fronts that of erosion of free. It's not just the family court here. This has seemed to be happening a lot recently in this country, that free speech is being eroded. And I just wondered, I know that free speech is one of the strengths of America, so I just wondered how things were in the family courts over there.
Yeah, so we're the complete opposite. All divorce filings are entirely public. Anyone can go to the courthouse and pull documents on any case and find out anything about anyone, unless they are done privately with a private judge. But even then, it is still a public record. So the only times that certain items are confidential are when, and this is somewhat antiquated law, actually, and there's a big discussion of opening this up, but when parties have children out of wedlock, they are not married, but they still have children, those cases are kept confidential. You can't look those up.
Right.
But cases that are just straight up divorces with children or not children, they're public record. So that's why even you have some celebrity divorces where they file paperwork with the courthouse, but to keep things more private, whatever's filed in the courthouse just says, there's a private agreement, just sign this, we're good. But otherwise, no, it's completely public and people can really look them up. Like even with a easy Google search, a lot of court cases come up.
Yeah. And so the parties are free to talk about the case outside of the court, are they?
Absolutely. I mean, it can't be done on there's certain levels of disparagement or certain things regarding confidentiality that might come into play.
Yeah.
There's also things where you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So, for example, if someone is getting spousal support as part of their divorce, the last thing they want to do is do something that would cause the payor's spouse to lose their job, right? Because if they lose their job, they're not going to be paying you spouse support anymore, and it's your fault, so you're not going to be able to help yourself.
Yeah.
So certain things just need to be done with that in mind. But at the end of the day, no, everything is really open and nothing is really that confidential. A prenup is a win-win situation.
Yes.
You have these conversations because I get people, it's not romantic. What if we break up? What if we it causes a fight between us? And I said, well, look, when you get married, I guarantee you, you're going to be talking about money at least once a week. Mm. You're going to talk about money all the time. And talking about money before you're married not only exercises those muscles in having really important, necessary conversations, but it's also setting your expectations straight as to how you guys are going to live. What are you going to do? What is going to be shared? What's not going to be shared? Talk about those things. And if you end up on the same page, fantastic. You're way ahead of the game on this. Yeah. And if it doesn't work out and you find that you're not right for each other, then you just don't get married. And that's a win too, right? Like the best thing you can do is not marry the wrong person.
Yeah.
And that helps you as well. So just having those conversations, talking about the prenup, talking about what your life is going to look like together is a huge benefit for a successful marriage in the future or not. And the thing is that people, they're like, well, we don't want to turn our marriage into a business deal. We don't want to have the law and talk about the law. And this, I'm like, well, what do you think marriage is to begin with?
Yeah.
It's a contract.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, when you get married, the laws of the state govern your marriage. Mm. That's it. You're going to do that whether you like it or not. So either you just say, well, let's let the government decide for us what is best for our marriage, or you can take the opportunity to really rewrite it and make it your own law. And that's the beauty. It's really one of the only opportunities that you have to rewrite the law to the point where it benefits you and your partner and your marriage, and you can get creative as long as it's not against public policy. And people don't understand that there's already a prenup written for you. It's California law. But if you want to rewrite it, you can. You already have a prenup. There's already one in place. A lot of attorneys don't want their cases to settle, because if it settles, it's done. You have attorneys that just want to make money and they're not really looking out for your best interests. They're not looking to help you. I mean, they're looking to help you, but they want to take the hard route because that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
So no one is looking for the quick, easy solution here. And I think that there can be more of a focus placed on that and really pushing more for mediation as a first tool to try to work things out. And then if it doesn't, then head over to litigation. But I think that when people are getting more prenups and having these discussions, it alleviates the litigation, at least on the financial aspect of things. Yeah. And people can really focus on the important things of their marriage as well as their divorce.
Episode 25 was with Thomas Williams and Roger Isaacs, who discussed their THI show, which is online, and their new blueprint.
I'm going to define again the true rule of law. We just mentioned that because this is
Can I just ask, you mentioned the golden rule. Is that synonymous with the true rule of law?
Yeah, they're one and the same.
One and the same, okay.
Swami's already called it out. You'll see it in all religions. Do unto others, you know, that concept. Essentially, you can break it down into all people of the same community are subject to the same law.
Yeah.
All are bound to live by the laws of the community. No one may be accused or seek relief except by law under the rule of law, and no one may be punished except by law under the rule of law. So all are equal under the same law. No one is above the law. So when you live in a world like we do today, where you see politicians and people giving themselves immunity, I was watching a thing in Arizona the other week where judges have pretty much given themselves immunity. You know you're living in a society where there is no true rule of law.
Right.
That is a sign that you're living in a tyranny right there.
So the golden rule is basically, in a nutshell, is do unto others as you would have done to you. Is that right, correct?
Yeah, that's one way to put it, absolutely.
Right, okay, great.
So this gets trippy fast.
Okay.
And I can build on that then, you know, that's helped give some background that I can pick up a bit of pace and relate it to what's going on, for example, when you've got a family law situation. And it comes down to understanding what is property, what is a person, and how rights are frozen in trust. There was a concept that came out of Roman times called occupation and possession. And what they realized back then was militarily, they couldn't take over everything, control everything. What they were really good at was creating roles of property and slave names. And essentially what they said is, we'll give you, you know, they say ownership is 9/10 of the law. So what they say, that 9/10 is right of use. Property actually means right of use. It does not mean you have the legal title. So what they said was, we'll give you the right of use. We'll hold the legal title. So you'll never actually own anything. And that's been going on since Roman times. They restored that through the Sesticae Vis. So when you're born in sin. Now, people think that you go to a church to get baptized. Well, it turns out they carry out the ritual baptism. Midwives do it at the hospital, and they don't even know they're doing it. And essentially, when the baby's born, they cut the umbilical cord, which means now you're lost at sea, you're afloat, and so you can be salvaged. They wipe your eyes and your mouth with water diluted with silver nitrate. Now, silver nitrate is the silver nitrates had the gold atoms removed. So now you get the gold that they're saying we're claiming ownership of your soul with, that Tommy just talked about. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they then trick the parents into registering the birth, the settlement, the docking. When you register something, you're transferring ownership of that name and that baby to whoever owns that register, which in this case would be the state or the crown. Mm-hmm. So parents don't realize that when they register the birth, they're transferring the ownership of that child to the state or the crown. You never actually legally own your child. A good question to ask at that point would be to go to the government or whoever the birth records office is and say, who's the trustee of this child? Now, the parents should be the trustee. They won't want to answer that question because they've made themselves the trustee when you register the birth. Okay, so the state claims legal title, legal ownership of the child. The parents have right of use. In other words, you raise the child, you take care of the child, you look after it. But they can come and take it from you anytime they want because you don't actually have legal title or own it. That's difficult to wrap our heads around, but that's the mechanisms they put in place. In the mechanisms they've put in place to drive this in the 1800s, initially ownership of the child was given to the church parishes, and the church parishes would give you a settlement certificate that allowed you to live in an area, build a home, feed yourself. If you didn't have a settlement certificate, you could be arrested and thrown into a workhouse. So there was a move to drive everybody off the land in the 1700s in England, especially because you've got to remember, prior to this, people lived on the land. They probably could feed themselves. they had a landlord, a lord of the manor, they were still much feeding themselves and self-sufficient. But in order to set up the Industrial Revolution and create a workforce, they had to disenfranchise, throw everybody off the land, not allow them to build homes or grow food, so refuse to give them a settlement certificate, and then they could throw them in the workhouses to earn their right to food and live. And this is run by the church, believe it or not. Now, that settlement certificate is the origin of the birth certificate.
Okay.
Okay, so the in the 1800s, they set up the municipalities, the public health acts, and they put all the mechanisms in place to transfer the guardianship of these the people, the paupers in the workhouses, over to the municipalities, the councils, right, and the state. And they put the current mechanisms in place that we see today as voter wards, county councils, municipalities, states, and all those things. So all the powers of guardianship, of custodianship, that came through these testative trusts were transferred from the church to the municipalities and the county councils. So person was defined in the modern term. People usually refer to Sir William Blackstone. And he refers to a person. I'm going to read what he says, because this is really important to understand.
Okay.
If you think when you're born, you should be born with natural creator-given rights that no one can take from you as a living man and woman, then they can't usurp that. Free will is one of the most powerful concepts of the universe. In fact, the universe will always resist tyranny. And if you look at history, whenever there is a tyranny exists, eventually free will overthrow that tyrant. That's why they realize we need to go to a mind influence system of government, like Tommy said, where we manage the minds of the slaves, because they know they can't usurp free will, but they can direct it.
And then they decide how we are going to live, how we are going to operate. You don't own your car because you registered it. You don't own the dog, and you certainly don't own your house. If you pay off your mortgage, and Roger can get into that, mort means death, remember?
Yes, yes.
Mortgage, we're gauging death on you.
Yeah,
So
it certainly feels that way with interest rates at the moment.
yeah. If you pay your mortgage off, you will then get a deed.
Yes.
On that deed, it will tell you you are not the owner of the house, you are the tenant.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you made about license allowing you to do something that otherwise would be illegal. And why is marriage? Why then do you need a marriage license?
Well, you don't. They made it a crime to live together. And I think it was in the 18th century, if you were living together and weren't married and you had children, they would come and take those children and sell them into bondage. And that's where the word bastards came from. And that was fully endorsed by the church as well.
Episode 26 was part one of our discussion with Edward James, author and dad. He talked about his case in a family court and his book, Bad Dad, The Truth Will Set You Free.
Basically, it was very quickly found out that the allegations were false. And after full investigations from everyone involved, I was allowed to start seeing my children, be it only for a couple of hours a week. And it had to be, it had to be supervised, which was pretty demeaning, I would say, quite embarrassing, having to call on family members, friends, to come and watch you with your children, who you know you're fine with, they know you're fine with, but because of allegations of any type of child abuse, has to be taken incredibly seriously until it's proven to be a safe situation.
What you describe, there are elements there that are fairly standard, sadly, with a lot of cases. I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
The progression, the false accusations, the abuse by proxy because being repeatedly investigated for false allegations, which, you know, as you rightly said, the investigations have to happen. Mm-hmm. But having to repeatedly defend yourself is apparent abusing by proxy. You've come through it, and also you mentioned, you know, that the abuse hit you on almost every level, physically, mentally, financially, emotionally. And I mean, again, that's very common, isn't it? It's just, I don't understand why the courts don't realize this. They seem almost unaware of the levels at which parental alienation and false accusations affect people in family courts.
I think you're right. I think it is overlooked, and I've had to, you know, I'm always trying to better myself and keep well and healthy. You know, I've had to seek support. And you know, I've had counselling. I've had, which has been hugely helpful, and actually has revealed to me that, you know, I've actually been in an abusive relationship marriage for, you know, 15 years.
Yes.
And culminating in the last three, which actually that alone, that self-realization that you've been in that situation, actually when you look at it and have someone else go through it with you, it's a big thing. But I think you're right, the courts don't, I think they seem, whether it's dads or mums or just parents as a whole, but I think that the affected parent, there's no realization of what's actually happened to them. And I know it's all about the children, but it's had a huge impact. It's really, really difficult. I think that half the reason I wanted to get into, you know, writing and putting pen to paper is and reaching out to people is to try and, you know, support people and speak to people that are struggling, because, you know, these were some of my darkest days where I couldn't see out and I had nothing. Whereas, before it all blew up, I was doing pretty well, you know, in all aspects of life.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm very much about sort of positivity, health, and, you know, mental, physical. And I want to just, you know, spread the word to people that thing, you know, things can be horrific. And, you know, when you're in it, you're in it, and there's no sort of escape from it. And it's only if you kind of a picture, it's being in a helicopter above and looking down at it as objectively as possible, then you can see that actually there is a way out. There will be something that's going to change. When you're in it, it's very hard to see that. But, you know, I've been in contact with a number of dads who have been struggling, and, you know, just, you know, they've wanted to know how I got through it and where I am now in speaking to people that are right at the beginning of the journey, you know, and it's, and just offering them some sort of reassurance and, you know, letting them pick my brains if they're going about to go through something similar.
Yeah.
Because I think as men, we don't talk enough. I think men's mental health needs to be addressed, to look after ourselves, but ultimately to be able to, you know, be an effective parent. We're the linchpin. The parents are the linchpins of the family. And if we're not working correctly, you know, if we're not functioning, if we're depressed, stressed, anxious, we're not going to be able to be, you know, optimum parents. So that's one of the main reasons that I decided to, you know, to write my books.
If you are a career criminal, if you go around stealing cars for 5 or 10 years, you're probably quite used to false accusations and probably just see it as an occupational hazard. Mm-hmm. If you're just an average law-abiding taxpayer who's never been in trouble, just the sort of thing that, I mean, at one stage, my first solicitor, I was in quite a bit of a state in the early days about the allegations being made because I'd never encountered anything like this. And she referred, she said, oh, don't worry, it's just low-level stuff. And it wasn't low-level to me, and I don't think it is to probably a lot of people in the early days of these situations. I think with the solicitors and barristers is they've probably seen so much worse that they probably are looking at it as perspective of, well, this is early on, you're going to see a lot more of this. Mm. You just don't realize it. And I don't know that they're very good with people who are new to the system in explaining that. And so you end up on a well-trodden path, but a path that you don't know anything about, and nobody's telling you. And this is, again, I've said it quite a few times on the podcast, I think this is why people such as yourself telling their story is so important. You just mentioned that you talked to some people who were just coming into the family law system. And I think it's so important to get stories like yours to them so that they can make some sort of sense of the path that they are possibly going to go down. One aspect like that where I constantly raised concerns and the solicitor was a bit, well, just didn't see things coming or didn't see things clearly. One catastrophic example of that in my case was the mother at the end of one hearing said that she would have to relocate. Nobody in the court and my solicitor picked up on this, but I did. And it got to the stage where the mother said she was going to relocate 3 hours away. Mm-hmm. Now, I raised this with my solicitor and she said, well, apply for a prohibitive steps order. So I said, okay. Now, I've since found out that the smart thing to do would possibly have been gone to the court in person and asked for an emergency order. Mm-hmm. But the solicitor just put it in the post and it sat around for a long time. But the solicitor also advised me to tell. I mean, it seems just ridiculous even saying it now, but she said, tell the mother that you are applying for this prohibitive steps order. And I have emails since that I've looked at since where I'm saying to the solicitor, this is not a good idea because she will just run. Mm. But the solicitor gave me, in her words, strong advice to tell the mother. At which point, this was fairly early on, it was just a few months into the case. And again, as a newcomer into the system, and I think lots of people will share this experience, you're a little bit in awe of things or intimidated by the process. And when somebody who's got years of experience gives you what they call strong advice, even if it's against your intuition, you can feel a pressure to follow that advice.
Absolutely.
Because you also worry, hang on, if I don't tell the mother, will I be criticised in court for not telling her? Mm-hmm. Going behind her back, raising up in the ante, I'm just playing devil's advocate because I've been in family courts enough to know that you can be criticised. They'll find an angle no matter how you've behaved.
Yeah.
So I did tell the mother, and guess what? So she ran, broke a court order, and my daughter remains 3 hours away 4 years later.
Wow.
Now, to me, that is a clear catastrophic error by the solicitor that has had horrendous consequences for my daughter and me.
Yeah.
But there's, as with a lot of mistakes in the family court, the targeted parent and the child or children are the only ones who bear the brunt of any errors. The solicitor got paid. The court did its business. And nobody, you know, my daughter and I are dealing with that constantly now, the traveling and the stress and other consequences I won't go into of that.
I've been dealing with, you know, high level London barristers who, you know, you struggle to think of how these people, how their conscience works to do what they're doing. All that money went, all of it. And I think that was just utilized, was meant to be used to buy the children somewhere to live, but in fact was used for expensive barristers, which was an utter waste of money.
I agree with your point as well about the people who are barristers in that industry. I mean, what they did was butcher me completely, but they had a 50-page judgment that said that the mother was abusive. So how they sit that with their conscience, I don't know. But I think that's just something that the legal profession doesn't seem to have a problem with in many cases.
I think another realization for me was, you know, at the beginning, it's all very much, well, you know, they're helping you. This person's going to help you do what you need to do, which they do. But then you have to, it suddenly clicks. Actually, do you know what? They are getting paid. That's their job. And they are, you know, they clock, you know, an email, they clock on the time it takes to read it. They bill you. And it's, you know, that's their career that they've chosen. But it's having that mind change that actually they are there to help you, but use them wisely, use their time wisely, because it just mounts up horrendously.
I think sometimes people in the new to the system might think, oh, this solicitor or barrister is in my court, they're batting for me, and they are to an extent, but you're just another punter, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think they don't care about your child or you. They'll do what they can, but in the same way, if somebody comes to paint your house, they'll do what they can, but they don't really care about your house, you know. I can understand a painter, a decorator having that point of view. I can't understand really a barrister or a solicitor, but yeah, that's just, I think it's just the way it is.
Well, you know, prime example that our situation was, although the decision was made, it was like, that's happening, the children will move. And despite all that money being made, all the investigations having taken place, the sort of all the evidence being there, it was challenged and taken to the High Court, which was very quickly thrown out. And you know, again, this is, if you have a barrister that would be like, yep, no, let's go for that, let's do that, that's a good idea, when knowing that actually there's very slim chances of anything changing, sort of demonstrates what their sort of end goal is. But there we go.
Episode 27 was part two of our discussion with Edward James.
I wonder whether parental alienation is rooted in, you know, mental illness. I mean, to actually do that to a child, I don't think you can be said to be well, because it's quite a planned, and it's over a long period as well. It's not just a one-off. And again, false allegations as well. It's an orchestrated campaign. So, and so I think you have possibly serious mental illness issues with parental alienation and false accusations in the family courts. But I think as well, you have mental health repercussions for the victim, the targeted parent, and the child or children. And I wonder if the family court should be reformed in the way that it handles this, that in that, you know, at the moment they recommend mediation from the start, but I wonder if there should also be a mental health, maybe a counselling offered to parents, both before and after court, because at the end of court as well, it's basically the court closes its book and off you go to deal with the fallout. And nobody monitors or cares about the mental health of either parent after court. And I think that things could be improved by looking at a mental health assessment or counselling before things go to court and afterwards as well. What do you think about that?
I think that would be hugely beneficial. I think that it would not only set the scene of the individuals involved and the family and the dynamics. You know, it doesn't have to be a huge in-depth. It would, you know, need access to records, etc., and some sessions to find out about the family. And I think afterwards as well, if there was like a small sort of monthly catch up, I think actually it's probably going to save the taxpayer money in the long run. With,
yeah,
you know, you think of the repercussions. I mean, I'm very lucky. I've had I've had some very good support with basically post-traumatic stress, and and had I not had that, I would be having to use other services. And you know, we live in a world where we're, you know, overpopulated and the NHS is hugely overwhelmed. If there could be a tag on, I think it would financially be better off for the country. Help support people a bit more afterwards, because it literally is, you know, final hearing, bye-bye, that's it, done. And that's the same with, you know, all the social workers, everything. And it was a bit of a like tumbleweed afterwards. Yeah. I absolutely agree. I think there should be some sort of package in place.
The family court doesn't keep statistics of outcomes. So it's almost guesswork. You know, it doesn't track a child's outcome 5 years after court, 10 years after court. And so we don't know if what judges and CAFCAS are recommending actually works. We don't know. So I think there are a couple of bolt-ons you could put at the end of these cases. And I think it would inform the system, which can only be a good thing. It just seems very bleak that they have this, as you say, you know, the cutoff at the end of the tumbleweed moment at the end of family court. And then no more, the system is just blind to whatever happens afterwards.
There doesn't seem to be any sort of like audit trail or it would be sensible, wouldn't it, to follow up and get some even after, you know, has this been a successful decision? You know, the decisions we've made, difficult decisions are made on a daily basis, but have they been the right ones? You know, how do we know that, you know, one judge might have a thought process that they continually come up with a similar sort of algorithmic thought process, and that might not be right, and that might not fit all cases. I think it would be very useful to have some kind of follow-up.
I mean, how do you improve a system if you don't know if it's performing well?
look at anything, any business, any, you know, it's always continual improvement, isn't it? It's governance, audits, it's in every industry, but it would make a huge amount of sense to do that. But again, it's money and resources and time. So,
I think children themselves should be educated about the family courts, because, you know, teenagers in a few years after they leave school, they may be in the family courts themselves. Mm-hmm. So it would benefit the children to know what they're going into, but also I don't think they believe what they were told. And so it might actually help to bring about some change. If I think in a lot of issues around the world, the children are the ones that are going, it's their world they're going to inherit. And I think that perhaps relying on people in their 30s, 40s and upwards who've been through the courts, that is very, very helpful and powerful as well. But I think also that the younger generations would help bring about change for themselves and everyone else. Everybody needs to be involved in this.
Definitely. No, I think help with some understanding, but also just people that aren't, like you said, your friend had gone through something and you didn't really have any understanding of it. I've experienced similar with people going, oh, is it all sorted now? And it's like, yeah. No, it's like nowhere near sorted. And it's just people think something is ruled and it something happens and that's it. It's a bit of an eye opener for people, I think. Anything that's going to help people's awareness is great.
You've written a book and other people who've been on this podcast have written books. How did you, does your court order allow you to do that, or are you doing it within parameters in the court order?
It's basically saying not to name people in the order and go into detail of the individuals being dealt with, which I haven't done. So that is what it says, and that's that's what I've done. So and also what I have written is the truth, and it's I understand that it would be not helpful against an auditor to sort of name people, etc. And that was not my intention. My intention is to expose, to highlight a situation and to, again, just it to be a positive message and to try and help people. That's my end game. It's nothing but that. And also it was done for me for kind of therapy, I guess. And it was a cathartic experience. And it's actually advocated by therapists. If you've been through trauma or you've, been abused, is to write your experiences down. It's to help you process events. So it's been a triggering yet useful process. I've spoken to professionals. They're like, if you get your parenting 50% right, then you're doing well. And as like a sweeping statement. So it's just trying to highlight the positives and highlight what has worked for me. So I hope it does find some use for some people.
Yeah, that's really good how you put that, because parents can be so hard on ourselves. We can be so self-critical, trying to be you haven't done this as well as you can. To hear that say, oh, so you're doing better than 50-50, then you do that. Better than 50%, that's pretty good. Because I think there's some of us, if we're not 99%, then we say, oh, could have done better,
Oh, exactly. And I think that's also echoed when I've spent time with other families, and you can see how they're looking after their kids. It's like, wow, actually, I'm doing quite well.
For anyone who's trying to write their story, do you have any tips for them? Or what was your writing process? Did you do it every day for a set amount of time, or just as and when?
I'm quite self-disciplined, and I would kind of set aside some time. But I'd also, some days I'd be in the mood for writing, other days I wouldn't. You've got to kind of just listen to how you're thinking and how much capacity you've got, especially if you've got kids around. And so it was kind of picking your moments, but some days it would really flow, other days not so much. I would try and do a few hundred words a day if I could. But everyone's different. I wouldn't have any particular tips. I think that just speaking, if you're writing about your own situations, just speaking from your heart and speaking openly, I think is really refreshing. And I would recommend it to anyone, even if you're not writing a book, just write stuff down. Actually physically rather than typing actually is quite good, putting pen to paper, because you've got more of a connection, I feel. I've done a bit of both, and I found pen to paper often is, you feel like you're actually putting something out there. Journaling is, I'm a big advocate of journaling. I would do that when I've had chronic insomnia because of the situation and have a journal by my bed and would wake up and start writing down problems or things that are on your mind. And then it's, you can sort of transfer that out of your brain. So for anyone that's struggling, I think writing is a newfound really helpful tool for me.
Episode 28 was a true story of a parent's struggle, narrated by Alana Hillenaar.
She then abducted our child 3 hours away, without parental agreement or court permission. She told Kafkas I sent threatening messages. When they asked to see them, she could not produce a single one. Kafkas recommended the travel burden was shared, but Anna then gave up her car and later, when I paid for hire cars for her, she even gave up her driving license. She asked my local police to do a welfare check on Elsie while in my care. They spoke to me by phone and declined her request. Anna also reported me to social services twice. They investigated and said there was no evidence against me. She called police 17 times alleging abuse. Police gave 112 pages of evidence to court showing I had done nothing wrong. Anna broke multiple court orders. She also said she thought I had torn Elsie's vagina, even getting a paediatrician to examine Elsie unnecessarily. Nothing was found. Anna separately alleged I had made Elsie's bum bleed. She also accused me many times of neglecting our baby. Anna demanded I write down every piece of food I fed Elsie. I did so for over a year until court stopped it. In 4 years, Anna only agreed to go to one mediation session. That was 2 years into the case. She chose the mediator. Afterwards, she refused any more sessions and refused permission for Kafkas and court to see the mediator's report. At Fact Find trial, I received 6 hours of hostile cross-examination from Anna's barrister. I was found innocent of her allegations. The written judgment described me as calm, sensible, and restrained. The court found Anna had gaslighted and undermined me, attempted fraud against me, told false and malicious allegations about me, and had committed parental alienation or attempted alienation. Despite this, somehow Anna now inexplicably receives legal aid for solicitors and a top barrister. For the last 2 court hearings, I have had to represent myself due to lack of funds. I believe Anna is creating conflict and dragging Elsie into it to prevent co-parenting. It is frightening if that works. Anna has tried every trick in the family court playbook. This is obvious, but the system is lacking. Over 4 years, Anna's abuse has severely damaged me socially, physically, financially, and emotionally. It amounts to 4 years of extreme psychological abuse. Now she wants Elsie dragged into it. We will end up with 3 damaged people because the court has judged there is abuse but has done nothing so far. I continue to offer mediation to no avail. Anna refuses to even say what the problem is. The trial judge was clear. He referred to her campaign to make seeing Elsie as hard as possible, if not stop it completely. Anna's use of the AAA, abuse, abduction, and alienation, is consistent with that aim. It is a simple case, but the system seems ill-equipped to deal with it. It is frightening and hugely damaging to me, my family, and Elsie that the family court system has seen the abuse and so far not acted. Short of death or illness, I can think of nothing worse than to be abused and alienated from your child. Many MPs and judges note flaws in the system. Those flaws are an abuser's dream. Good parents are tortured within the system and some take their own lives. Abusers get legal aid to further abuse.
Episode 29 was myself discussing the book, the very famous book, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and I discussed a little bit about what the book's about and how it helped me with coping with trauma and struggle that I went through. But examples of coping with adversity don't get much more difficult than, of course, concentration camps in World War II, which is where Viktor Frankl's book is set. The book helped me so much. I was listening to this around the time of the first court hearing. False allegations had just started. False allegations hurt and damage, and they damaged me. And I was in turmoil because they were being used as justification for me stopping, for me not being allowed to see my child. And I'm sure this is familiar to a lot of people, but in the first few months I couldn't believe that this went on in Britain, and or was allowed to, and I was just in a state of shock and despair. Once you're in the family court for a few years, you realise just how bad it is. I was suffering a great deal in early 2019, and that gave me reason to seek out the book. I used to wake in the middle of the night. I wasn't seeing my child. My baby was less than 6 months old. When I read the book, I was stopped from seeing my child when they were 2 months old. I didn't see them again till they were 6.5 months old. And it was at around this time that I read the book and revisited it. And it wasn't just one read, I came back to it. Anyway, I was in the middle of this period. I was working at the time, trying to hold down a job, trying to sleep at night. I used to wake in the middle of the night, hearing a child cry, my baby cry, but obviously there was nobody there. I didn't know if my baby was crying, how my baby was. I wasn't told anything, really. One social worker said that they called up, my baby was crying but sounded okay, and I was told that the health visitor said she was okay, and that's it for 4.5 months. Where's the humanity in that? I'm not going to go into the book much more than that. I've covered where I was in my journey and how it helped me, and a brief idea of what it's about. But it basically examines different outcomes in concentration camps. Some people survived, some didn't. And the book examines possible reasons why. It's to do with meaning. Some people had children they wanted to survive for. Others had things they needed to do after the war. Part of it is about having a reason to touch the future, to get to the future, and some didn't have that. I'm not going to try and summarize the book for you. I'm just going to recommend it because I can't do it justice. It's something that you kind of have to read yourself. When I say going through the hell of the family court, I hesitate about possibly using the word evil. And when I talk about abuse from an alienating or abusive parent, I hesitate to describe that as evil. One of the reasons is, of course, a nasty solicitor will attack you, tear you to shreds in a court if you've used the word evil. But also because I've struggled with it, that, you know, what is evil? You know, the nature of evil. It goes into a philosophical possible rabbit hole that is not productive. But just to riff on it for a little bit, there's a quote of Einstein's, paraphrasing it, I think. Basically, he says, the world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, but by those who watch them without doing anything. And I think that's a really powerful quote. I mean, certainly we see in the family court people who can see what you may describe as evil and do nothing, and that certainly does make cases worse. But is Einstein right? I think he is. But the question I'm wrestling with is, what do you define as evil? I'm not talking about it in the biblical sense. I think you can see evil in a practical sense, in terms of, say, for example, unbridled malice. The wish to do harm to people who have done nothing wrong, the wish to alienate a child, the act of seeing somebody doing that and doing nothing or even helping them by being a lawyer for them or a CAFCAS officer who sees all of that and then backs them, or many other examples we could name from the family courts. Some people in court who will help an abuser alienate a child. This to me is not biblical evil, it's human evil. It's not human good, is it? I've seen enough to know in my heart that many people in the family court know what they are doing, and yet they still do it for their purposes. In the case of lawyers, it's for money. People, parents, good parents can die in these cases. Good parents can end up with critical illnesses or trauma for life. But still, nasty lawyers do what they do. And in my view, that's evil. And in my view, Einstein is right. That's all I've really got to say on that. As I say, I'll be criticised for it. But it's something I've thought about for a while, and I just wanted to get it out there. Let me know if you agree with that. Back to Man's Search for Meaning. All I can say, again, I'm not going to talk in depth about it. I can't do it justice. But all I can say is it helped me. It's helped others. And I would just say, if you're going through hell, tough times, whatever, please find it. It's on YouTube. It's in bookshops. I think there's a good chance it will help you. So that's our run through of episodes 21 to 29. Thanks to all the guests who make the shows, and thanks to the listeners for listening to them. I hope you enjoyed it. Take care. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.